The show from the University of Georgia and is the senior attorney and senior research fellow for Berkeley's law and technology program and the Samuelson Clinic. His focus is on computer privacy law. And interestingly, Chris comes to this with an extensive background in privacy. He was the senior counsel to the Electronic Privacy Information Center and director of the organization's West Coast office. At Epic, Chris concentrated on financial services privacy, telemarketing regulation, and consumer profiling. He's testified before Congress and the California Senate and Assembly numerous times, published law review articles on privacy and free speech, commented in over 1,000 news stories. Wow, that's a lot. All right. So this is maybe 1,001, roughly, on privacy, and is admitted to practice in California and the District of Columbia. So we've got an exceptionally well-qualified and interesting person to talk to today. So when we come back from a short music break, I will put Chris on the air. But I also want to note that you are listening to this show live today. Generally, I've had guests on who were pre-recorded because of their lack of proximity to Stanford. Chris has been generous enough to head south from Berkeley and join us today. So we are recording live. And we are, well, hopefully we'll have this up as a podcast on iTunes after the show is aired. But sit back and hopefully we'll have an interesting discussion on issues involving privacy. So, Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Why don't we start off? I gave a brief introduction of who you are. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what leads you to being a person who's so steeped in privacy issues? How did you get into this stuff just by way of background?
Well, when I was in college and law school, I was a student activist. And at that time, I was really into free speech, free expression on campus. My campus had actually banned the use of sidewalk chalk, believe it or not. And we found that very offensive, and we noted that there was no avenue for anonymous speech absent sidewalk chalk. So right. I actually created a student organization at University of Georgia called An Organization, because as an organization, you were allowed to put up flyers and whatnot and speak in your capacity as a student. And we protested the sidewalk chalk rules. And flowing from those experiences, I learned a lot about privacy and political advocacy and decided to devote my career to it.
Huh. So it all started with people telling you can't write on sidewalks with chalk. That's, you know, and I think it's apropos because in some ways that's a little bit of the society we have now, except it's not chalk that we're dealing with. Let's jump right in to the first topic that I mentioned because it is so timely. So pretexting, I imagine, is a term which until, you know, less than a week ago, most people probably had never heard before. They might have had some nebulous idea of what it is to have your identity stolen or people getting their hands on information that they otherwise shouldn't have. But why don't you, for those who aren't well-versed in this stuff, why don't we start off by kind of asking you to define the term?
Sure. Pretexting is identity theft. And identity theft, someone uses your personal information in order to steal money from you. So they pretend to be you and they gain control of your bank accounts and then they go out and buy stuff that they want. Pretexting is exactly the same. They use information about you, but instead of getting your money, what they do is they get information about you. And there's an extremely wide variety of records that are subject to pretexting. For instance, one might use pretexting against a utilities company to learn about where you live, or your telephone company to see the people with whom you speak. So essentially, any company that has personal information about you can be the target of pretexting. It's a widespread investigative practice, and very little is known about it because it is so hard to catch a pretexter. When a pretexter calls up a phone company or a bank to get your information, if they are unsuccessful, they just hang up the phone. So they're very difficult to catch, and they employ all sorts of different technologies to have a cloak of anonymity when trying to get your information.
So, I mean, are we dealing with something that's akin to the what's become relatively famous on the internet, but the oil schemes and the Nigerian schemes where you get the emails that say, would you send me $10,000 and I'll free you of an oil contract? Is it the same concept? Is it really ultimately a criminal endeavor to attempt to get information that you shouldn't otherwise have, or is it something less nefarious than that, or can it be both?
Well, it depends on the context, unfortunately. There is no specific law that prohibits pretexting. The way law enforcement goes after these people is by getting them on computer intrusion laws. So when you call up the phone company to steal my phone records, what you are doing is you're manipulating a customer service representative, and you're getting that representative to open up my consumer file. And technically, that's hacking. And it's been successfully prosecuted under those laws. But again, in order to prosecute it, you got to know that it happened. And in most cases, when people are using pretexting, they use the information for investigative purposes. They never introduce it in court. You would never go in front of a judge and say, Your Honor, I hired a private investigator to break into Chris's account. Instead, you use it for intelligence gathering purposes so you can find out things about another person without spending a lot of money on subpoenas, you know, all those legal processes that cost money.
Yeah, right, right. Things that get in the way. As
yes.
It were. Yeah. Yeah, and I guess which leads me into a practical question before talking about, you know, where we are with the issue. You mentioned that it's difficult to find out. So we have a situation, without getting into the specifics of Hewlett-Packard, but based on what's been reported, you have a situation where basically it was leaked that something like this happened. But as a general matter, when you don't have a situation like that, first of all, how does law enforcement find out about this? And then secondly, as a consumer, is there any way of knowing whether it happened to you or not?
We generally learn of pretexting incidences when something terrible happens that's associated with the pretexting. So the number one case that we know about in the privacy community is the Amy Boyer case. And this is a very tragic incident where a young woman was stalked and killed by another person. And this other person located Amy Boyer through private investigators who were using pretexting. Amy Boyer led a rather private life. She didn't have credit cards, so she didn't have a digital footprint. And so in order to find her, the investigators actually had to call her home. They pretended to be an insurance agency, and they say, we need to know where Amy works because we have an insurance claim for her, and we're going to give her money. And the mother was fooled by the subterfuge, revealed her workplace location, and the killer went and met her there. So unfortunately, it's usually these extreme cases where you learn about pretexting. With regard to Hewlett-Packard, the only reason why we know that the company used pretexting is that one of the directors suspected that he was surveilled, and he employed a number of techniques to learn what the company did, and eventually forced Hewlett-Packard to admit that they used the tactic. So there's a number of reasons that come together to prevent people from learning about pretexting. One of the most interesting ones is that typically when you're a victim of pretexting, it's because you're being investigated for something that you might not want to talk about. And the prime example is marital infidelity. So your spouse might hire a private investigator to see who you're calling in order to determine whether or not you're having an affair. And after that happens, no one wants to go to the police or to a judge and say that my spouse pulled my phone records because they thought I was a cheat.
Right.
There are a number of factors that are coming together to prevent pretexting from coming to light.
You mentioned, I mean, I'm tempted, and I think I may ask at the end if you have any practical tips for people dealing with this. But before I get to that, I want to go back to a comment that you made, which is that there are no laws on the books specifically dealing with pretexting. But it strikes me, and I'm forced to put on my lawyer hat briefly, that we do have laws certainly that can be used. I mean, you mentioned we're all dealing with with situations, what you're describing are situations effectively involving deception, and fraud obviously comes to mind as a way to handle this. Certainly at the civil level, it seems to me that an individual could bring an action alleging fraud and what have you. How much of a need do you think there is for specific statutes to deal with pretexting? Is there a true weakness in the law on the civil or criminal side that requires that we revisit this issue, or perhaps even visit it for the first time and come up with a dedicated statute?
On the criminal side, there are clear vectors for attacking the practice. Mm-hmm. There are the computer hacking laws, wire fraud laws, standard fraud laws, as you've noticed. You can even use identity theft laws to go after pretexters.
Mm-hmm.
So on the criminal side, we're pretty much covered. The civil side is where there's weakness. The primary federal law one would use is a computer hacking law. But in order to invoke this law, you have to show that you've been damaged. You have to show $5,000 worth of damage. And most people can't show that damage. Furthermore, if you use common law torts, let's say you sue someone and you say you've invaded my privacy or you have stolen my records, one of the arguments you hear from the other side is that these aren't your records. They are actually, technically, they are owned by the phone company, so they are not your records. And they will also argue that they're not private. After all, you tell the phone company who you call.
Right.
So we really need a cause of action on the civil side to pursue the bad guys here.
And what would you mentioned the damages, and yes, it would seem that $5,000 would be virtually impossible to show unless you had something as highly publicized as, you know, perhaps the Hewlett-Packard situation. What would you suggest be the basis upon which to bring a claim? How would you establish that level of damages or standing to have a claim? What would be the Chris Hufnagel legislative solution? And if you've given it any thought, I don't want to slam you with a question that may require more thought than a 1 hour radio show.
I think the model legislation is actually in Illinois.
Oh, really?
It essentially treats all pretexting as identity theft. So if you employ the personal information of another person for fraudulent purposes, it's identity theft. And it doesn't matter if you're trying to steal money or steal records. And that applies, in that state, it applies to all records. And so another kind of interesting aspect of this debate is that the California law that just passed to deal with this problem only applies to phone records. So the investigators, when faced with this law, are going to say, okay, I can't pretext phone records, but, you know, I can pretext your utility records or your cable records. So it's a continual battle, and until we have laws like the Illinois one that is a blanket prohibition, I think we're going to be battling this for some time.
Yeah, and that kind of leads me into another question, which how prevalent do you think this practice is? I mean, again, I think for those that aren't looking at it every day and aren't privacy experts like you, this may come as a little bit of a surprise. How do you have any sense of how prevalent the practice is? You know, in let's focus on the corporate setting. I mean, is this something that's more common than one would expect?
No one knows for sure. We're looking at these problems through a glass darkly, as with a lot of other privacy problems. However, there is one really interesting fact. In a lawsuit brought against a Florida private investigator, the attorney general of that state discovered that this investigator called Verizon Wireless 5,000 times in a single month.
Wow.
And so that obviously is a lot of pretexting, and that's one company calling one phone carrier. So that suggests that there's a lot of pretexting going on, but no one knows for sure.
Wow. Well, if you didn't know that this was real, you would think that this was a cliffhanger for a movie. It's amazing. And I think this may be the earliest time that I say, Chris, you should come back maybe in 6 months. We're not ending the interview now. Thank you very much for coming. But I think this is an interesting topic to follow up on, because I would suspect that because of now that it's front page news, that there's going to be some legislative action. I'd love to continue the conversation. I do want to move into a couple of other areas and just see where the conversation goes before coming back to pretexting, perhaps at the end. This issue of pretexting really turns us to another general topic area, which I think is fascinating, which is just security breach laws generally. And that's another issue that, again, people, I think, who casually use technology or casually interact with businesses or with banks or what have you, don't often think about. Where are we with the state of the law? And I think the pretexting issue kind of starts us in that direction.
Security breach litigation is going to be huge in the upcoming years, and the laws that have passed in the states have created a revolution in a lot of different companies. And so let me back up and explain that by saying that in July 2003, a California law took effect that requires companies and the government to give notice when a security breach occurs involving certain personal information.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, there have been over 200 recorded instances of security breaches that have resulted in letters actually going out to consumers that say, good morning, your data were stolen and some way or another. So since the California law passed, 32 other states have enacted similar laws. Some are broader, some are narrower. And now on the federal level, Congress is considering nationalizing the law, in part to create consistency. The prediction was that this law would pass this year, but you know, we only have a couple legislative days left in September, and then there's a lame duck session later this year, and it's unlikely that the law will pass this year.
When you say nationalize, of course, you mean federal law that would apply across the states. You mentioned the number of states that are passing these laws. Is there a sense of why the other states haven't gone in that direction yet? Is it simply just that it hasn't hit their radar screen, or is there any opposition to the notion that such a law needs to exist?
Oh, there's tremendous copycatting in the states.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great network among legislative lawyers who work in state capitals across America. And if one state gets a good idea that's politically popular, that works, it gets copycatted other places. And in California, we really have been the leader in personal privacy. And so not only has our security breach legislation been copied, a dozen of our other laws have been copied throughout the West, including our regulations on Social Security numbers. So 32 states have acted. Generally, it's very hard to oppose these laws because, after all, these companies have collected your data and they're profiting from your data. If they lose it, they owe you something.
Mm-hmm.
And that common sense argument has proved persuasive.
It's a fascinating area because there's been, you know, several high profile stories of the government itself losing data that should be held private. And I guess I kind of want to touch on that a little bit. In the realm of trade secrets, an area that I've written about and continue to write about, there's often a concern on the part of businesses that in order to do business with the government, they need to tell the government some of their trade secrets. And they are concerned that through nothing more than an error, their trade secret being held by the government could suddenly be let go. Therefore, they would lose the economic benefits of maintaining the trade secret. The government is in the ironic somewhat position now of having to enforce these laws when they themselves have had very, very high profile losses of data, which people are familiar with, but you know, ranging from information about potential clandestine agents to information involving the operation of nuclear. I mean, it's incredible, and you're far more familiar with them than I am. What is there a sense of where the government can fall on this, given that they themselves have had these high profile problems?
It's actually one of the most embarrassing aspects of security breach notification.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if you look at the numbers, if you look at the 200 or so breaches, a huge number of them are actually government actors. The largest percentage of breachers is actually educational institutions.
Mm-hmm.
They comprise about 36% of security breaches. But when you look at the raw numbers, so when you look at the number of records that are breached, the business world tends to be the greater offender. But if you scan the landscape, you'll see colleges and universities of California issuing security breach notices all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason there is that the California law applies both to government and to the private sector. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a lot of other states, it only applies to the private sector.
So that's a law that holds both to the same standard, or are there any significant differences that would color one's willingness as a legislator to apply that law across the board?
Well, there are a lot of political reasons why you don't want to apply it across the board.
Right.
One of them is that when you get these statistics back that show that the government has so many security breaches, it actually lends ammunition to the private sector. And they say, don't regulate us until you clean up your house.
Right.
And so that's one of the big political motivators of not extending those laws to the government. And, of course, they should apply to the government, too. But there are often political concerns that prevent them from doing so.
Are security issues generally, and maybe now I'm asking more a question that's anecdotal. I mean, having talked about these issues to a large, diverse group of audiences, are people generally, I'm not talking about legislators now, just your average public, in your experience, are people on board with the notion that this is a problem? The reason I ask the question is that a lot of times, especially lately, in the environment that we're in, people tend to view the idea of a security problem as often either hyperbole or overblown or nothing more than some ulterior issue that they are not familiar with. So when they say, oh, this is a security problem, I can't discuss it with you, I can't tell you, it's considered to be not in the pretext sense that we were just describing, but nothing more than a cover. When you talk to people about these issues, are people generally on board with the idea that security breach issues are a major problem and that everyone needs to be aware of it? Or do people often have the attitude of, what do people really want to know about me?
You know, that is a great question. Something like 85% of Americans, when polled, will say that they should get notice of all security breaches, even when there's no criminal intent, even when there's no risk of harm. They want to know.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you ask them, what do you really do when there's a security breach? About half of them do nothing. A small percentage will monitor their credit reports, and 19% when polled say that they will actually leave the company that had the security breach, and they'll actually go to a competitor if they can. So that's one of the greatest questions out there, and it's one of the things I wrestle with all the time, because we have a lot of public polling that says that people care about privacy, but then they take actions that often make their privacy problems worse, or they don't take any action at all. And so is that a problem of observation? Is that a problem of consumers not having the right tools? Is it a problem of consumers not having enough time to effectuate their intent? These are some of the questions I'm trying to answer at Berkeley. We don't know the answer to them.
And there are projects that are taking a look at trying to get at the root of this issue.
Yeah, and oftentimes the problem is that it takes a lot of research to protect your privacy. And in fact, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today of a rather computer savvy reporter talking about his experience using web anonymization software and how he's trying to have privacy on the internet, and all of a sudden he can't go to the websites he wants to go to, and his wife wants to know why he's covering his tracks. Protecting your privacy is difficult, and a lot of the tools out there are too labor-intensive for average people to use.
Why don't we take a short music break here? I think at the close of the show, I would be remiss to not ask you for a couple of tips on what people could do that may not be self-evident. But let's take a short music break, and when we return, I, Dave Levine, you're listening to Hearsay Culture, will return with Chris Hufnagel. Before we return to Chris, I wanted to point out that I hope you like what you're hearing. And I'd like you to consider to help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area. So the ultimate plug, please donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. And don't forget to keep on listening. So we're back here with Chris Hufnagel of Berkeley and the Samuelson Law Clinic. And Chris, why don't we turn to another topic, which moves us in the direction, again, of what people can do to protect information about themselves. And that is generally the Fourth Amendment. Again, Hearsay Culture is a show dedicated to attempting to inform people who are not immersed in these issues about what's going on in the technology world and the law. So why don't you give a brief overview of what the Fourth Amendment is in the context of technology and what the main issue is right now?
Well, the Fourth Amendment is the primary way in which we our privacy is protected from government actors. And the way it's been interpreted over the years is mainly to protect the home. So we all know that if police want to search our home, unless there's some emergency or some other circumstance, they need to go get a warrant. They need to go to a judge and show that they have probable cause that a crime has been committed inside your home before they can show up and force entry. Well, what we have been thinking about for some time here is how to make those protections relevant in the digital age. The Fourth Amendment really is it fetishizes the home. And a lot of the judges who interpret the Fourth Amendment will limit its protections to the home and not think about new ways in which our privacy can be invaded by the government.
And I'm sorry.
So, you know, the primary issue here is that so many of our papers, so much of our life is now no longer in the home. Our banking records are at our bank. Our telephone calling records are at our phone carrier. Our medical records are everywhere. So how will the Fourth Amendment protect these records? And that is the inquiry that many lawyers across the nation have been trying to address. A 1976 Supreme Court decision held that when you give information to a third party, let's say your doctor, your bank, etc., you lose your Fourth Amendment rights in that information. And what that essentially means is that if you want Fourth Amendment privacy records, and your life can't leave the home. We're trying to figure out how to get that umbrella of protection to extend a little bit further so that you can expect to have real protections for all sorts of records that are in the hands of third parties.
There's a phrase that I hear criminal lawyers use a lot, and we should delve into, which is the Miller issue or the Miller problem, referring to the case U.S. v. Miller. Why don't we talk a little bit about that case? First of all, what is the case, why is it important to what we're discussing?
Well, Miller is an exciting case. It was a Georgia bootlegging case where a man was suspected of running liquor, and the police, in order to prove their case, went to his bank and asked the bank to hand over his records, which showed deposits, large cash deposits, that would support a criminal prosecution for running illegal alcohol. And what's interesting about the case is that the defendant, Miller, challenged this practice. And they said, Miller argued that if you're going to go to my bank and get my information, my financial records, you should first get a subpoena or warrant. You shouldn't be able to just go get it, and the bank shouldn't just be able to give it to you. What's interesting is that the Court of Appeals in that case agreed with the defendant Miller, and they said that your banking records are private, and one would expect to have some type of constitutional protection over them. But the Supreme Court reversed. And essentially, the Supreme Court's reasoning was that one assumes the risk that their information will be transferred to the government if they do things like establish a bank account. The Supreme Court also noted that these are just business records. They are routinely collected, and they're not really private. And the implication of that is that if you want to have financial privacy, you have to keep your money under your mattress. Quickly after that decision was rendered by the Supreme Court, Congress moved in to create privacy protections for financial records. They're weak, but they are protections. But that law that Congress passed only pertains to financial records. So under this doctrine in this Miller case, the police can go to other records carriers and get your information without your knowledge or permission, and there's little one can do about it.
It's a pretty remarkable decision as you describe it, and it leads us into in the issue of the Fourth Amendment, what I think is a topic that we discussed briefly before on the air, and I want to delve into. The Miller problem, using that phase, often comes up. On it, when you're dealing with the issue of transactional data. And transactional data, like many of the terms we use, is a term of art. What is transactional data, and again, how does this relate to the issue involving that came out of Miller?
Well, transactional data simply records how you use a service. So an example would be a record that showed that you called a certain phone number on a certain date, and the amount of time you spoke on the phone. And what's interesting about transaction surveillance or looking at these records is it really is the primary way in which law enforcement and intelligence agencies investigate you, because they can look at those transactions, and they don't even need to know the content of the transaction. They don't need to know what you talked about to map out a lot of aspects of your life. Who's closest to you? What businesses you frequent, etc. And through transaction surveillance, you can map out an entire criminal network, if assuming you can get data on all the participants.
So it leads us into the timely issue, and I'll just take it to its most, perhaps it's certainly most perhaps most extreme and certainly most elaborate scenario, which is national security. I mention it just because if you just take a look at issues involving money laundering and trying to trace the financial relationship between terrorism and its financiers, you often deal with issues where you're literally just tracing back these transactions. A criticism of the law as you describe it would be, or a criticism of not changing the law as you describe it, I should say, would be that law enforcement requires these tools in this new age. What's your response to that as a privacy advocate? And is that in fact true?
Well, it's an interesting problem. After the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act contained all sorts of provisions to facilitate preventative monitoring of financial transactions. But what's interesting is that in most of the hearings and most of the studies that have followed up on that issue, it's been found that law enforcement is not using these tools as in a preventative model. They're still using it retrospectively as a crime has occurred. When one brings up the specter of terrorism, it makes it difficult to even talk about these issues. And it might be the case that we need different rules for genuine terrorism investigations than we do for standard criminal investigations. But generally, in the criminal aspect, law enforcement is acting retroactively. Mm-hmm. And if a crime has occurred and there are certain people who have suspicion, there should be the ability of law enforcement to go through some process and get access to these records. What we're arguing is that process is currently inadequate, that mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, law enforcement can simply walk into a business and say, give us these records, without any showing of need or suspicion. And we think that balance has not been struck correctly.
Do you see that there's a change afoot in this area? Are there any cases that people should keep an eye out for that are attempting to challenge the parameters of the search?
There's a lot of different aspects at play that are changing the way in which businesses interact with law enforcement. You'll note that recently Google challenged a request by the Department of Justice to obtain all sorts of transactional records about people who had used the company's search engine. And the company received a lot of support and a lot of criticism from doing that. But there is some pressure coming from the public There is perhaps some competitive advantage to distinguishing yourself and standing up to some of these requests. And there's also information security and other privacy laws that are tightening around a lot of different companies that I think is going to make them less likely to share information. So I don't see California or any other state coming forth with some law that restricts information flows from businesses to the government. But there are other trajectories to ramping up protections for personal information that have been effective in the last 10 years.
Unfortunately, as always, I run into the hour becoming far too inadequate, and yet somehow I still resist the idea of doing a three-hour talk show with one guest. Maybe it's, as much as I like hearing myself talk, I'm not sure that too many other people would want to hear 3 hours of conversation. Let me turn quickly in the time we have left to a couple of things, and I want to close the show with some practical tips to consumers. But first, just quickly on the issue of public records. On the way over, you told me you gave me a fact and a scenario which really surprised me involving the use of Social Security numbers. So I'll just let you tell that story, and then I have a follow-up question. But it was a kind of a surprising state of the law that I personally wasn't aware of.
Well, several years ago, there was an incredible legislative battle over whether or not Social Security numbers should be protected by federal law. And there's a lot of companies out there that claim that they have a First Amendment right to buy and sell your Social Security number. And in fact, federal law allows people to buy and sell Social Security numbers, as does state law. So one enterprising consumer group actually hired a skywriter, and they flew up into the sky, and they skywrote the Social Security number of one of these corporate executives in the sky, just to make the point that if the companies are going to buy and sell Social Security numbers, there's no reason why one couldn't go paint one into the sky and have no consequences.
Unbelievable.
Not something that I would support, but it does show that there are inadequate legal protections for the SSN, and it's actually driving identity theft and a lot of other problems that we're seeing today.
The you generally hear and you're told whenever you listen to or watch any TV program, one thing they'll say immediately to you is that you should, whenever you can, ask a company or an employer or what have you to use something other than your Social Security number for purposes of identification. And we think, or we're trained to think in some ways, that because you get a document back that uses the last four numbers of your Social Security number, that somehow that's safer. And yet those last four numbers seem to now be very easy to obtain. And you've described several ways that entities are able to get their hands on this stuff. It leads me into the practical question, which is, if you're sitting at the table advising someone on how to protect their personal data in a world where pretexting is occurring and we don't know how much, where security breaches are occurring across the board, not only in the private sector but in the public sector, what would you say would be some of the less intuitive or less discussed ways that an individual could go about protecting their personal information?
Well, the first advice I always give is to engage in privacy self-defense. This is the idea that you're going to make a commitment in your life to be a little bit more skeptical when people ask you for your personal information. Americans are very open and trusting people. It's not true everywhere in the world. If you ask people from other places in the world their personal information, they'll actually give you some resistance. But we are way too eager to just put our personal information on product warranty cards, on surveys, on website registration. And the result of that is that there's a lot of people who get your information by simply asking for it. And we volunteer it too easily. So the main point I always make is to be more skeptical. Whenever you're in some situation where someone or something is asking for your personal information, you might ask why, or do I need to give it to you? You'll find that oftentimes you don't. there are a number of things, other things one can do to protect their privacy. I'm not going to go into my full list, but one of the most important is to opt out of credit card marketing. You can do it in 5 minutes. All you have to do is call a phone number. It's 1-888-5-OPT-OUT. And if you call that phone number, it actually will opt you out of 90% of credit card marketing. It'll make you much more immune to identity theft because identity thieves often steal those offers in order to get credit cards in your name. And as far as pretexting goes, you mentioned the problem of those last four Social Security number digits being available out there. What's ironic about that is that the phone carriers use that as your password to get your phone records. So all these pretexters out there who are getting phone records, they don't even have your full Social Security number. All they need is those last four digits. One of the keys there is to set a password on all of your accounts. So when you talk to your bank or you talk to your credit card company or to your phone company, all of them will allow you to put a password on your account that is not your Social Security number. And you might use the name of your first pet or the name of the first elementary school you went to. And you won't forget that. And that's one way to secure yourself against pretexting.
It kind of leads into, you know, one additional area, which is oftentimes, you know, on forms, like you were saying, you get asked to put in your Social Security number and it's not evident why. Is it a reasonable response for people to refuse it in all instances? In other words, it's one thing if your employer says, I need your Social Security number in order to comply with IRS tax regulations and immigration and what have you. But is it a reasonable thing in the normal day-to-day to simply say to a company, no, I'm not going to give it to you, and then either suffer the consequences or simply just have something happen beyond that? What is there a general rule as far as using that?
This is a very complex area of consumer law. In California, no company may deny you a product or service if you refuse to give out your Social Security number. Now, the problem with that rule is that it does not apply when the company is doing a credit check on you. And lots of companies are doing credit checks on you. And in fact, credit checks have become so inexpensive that many common transactions, such as opening up an account at a video rental store, can trigger a credit hit. So there's no hard and fast rule to give to consumers about their Social Security number. The best thing to do is to put up some resistance. Ask them why. Ask them, do you have to give it? But generally, if the company is going to check into your credit, you're going to have to give it, and your only remedy is to vote with your feet.
Well, Chris, this has been a great interview. I want to ask you in closing, if for people that want to learn more about these issues, are there any websites or sources or anything that you think people should turn to find out more not only about what you do but also about these issues?
There are two, I think, really stellar websites on privacy. One is of my former employer, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. That's online at epic.org. The other top privacy website is the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse website, and that's at privacyrights.org.
Chris, thank you so much for driving south from Berkeley and coming down here today for this terrific discussion and pretty wide-ranging. Like I said, I do invite you back, and hopefully you'd like to return.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I want to thank Chris Hufnagel for coming down here today, having a really terrific discussion on the far-ranging issues dealing with privacy. I'm pleased to say that we'll be doing a privacy back-to-back discussion, because next week I will be having Lauren Gelman, the assistant director of the Center for Internet and Society here at Stanford, who I work with and who is also another person who spent her career looking at issues involving privacy and the First Amendment. So Lauren will be a nice second person to speak to involving privacy issues and touch on some other fascinating issues dealing with those areas. Chris came down here and talked about about these issues, I do encourage you to check out the two sites that he mentioned. The Epic site is a terrific one, and so is the other. Epic is an organization that's been around for quite a while and has touched on these issues for at a very substantive level for a long time, so I do recommend that. I also would recommend generally, as I often have, to check out the CIS website, which is at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As I mentioned, not only Lauren Gelman, who'll be on next week, but Jennifer Granick, the executive director, who I had on several months ago when I started the show, are both people who have spent a ton of time dealing with these issues and who have a lot of interesting things to say about them. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in these issues, to take a look at the website cyberlaw.stanford.edu. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture. Coming up at 6 o'clock will be Your Imaginary Friend and Brownie in Motion. So I look forward to talking to you next week with Lauren Gelman, another live show, as we decide to go edgy and not have the relative comfort of a recording and go straight live with our discussions. So I hope you've enjoyed the talk today. Thanks again to Chris, and I look forward to talking to you next week.